August is here, and it has that Sunday of summer kind of feeling. It's a moment to slow down, reset, and prepare for the busy fall season. And a great place to start with that transition is with your wardrobe. There's no better place to do that than Quince. Their clothing is a reminder that you don't need to crowd your closet with endless new pieces. You just need the right high-quality essentials. Quince specializes in effortless staples, from organic cotton t-shirts to Mongolian cashmere sweaters. I personally recommend their washable silk slip dress. Pair it with a blazer for work, then wear it straight out to dinner. Everything Quince makes is priced 50 to 80% less than similar luxury labels because they partner directly with ethical factories, cutting out the middleman markup entirely. And it's not just apparel. Quince brings that same affordability to hotel quality bedding, plush bath towels, and sleek home staples. Upgrade your everyday with Quince. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/campus. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/campus.
Sometimes it feels like the news is full of things that have never happened before. And that is not exactly true. In fact, it may have happened this very week, hundreds or thousands of years ago. I'm Sally Helm, host of the podcast History This Week from the History Channel. Trade embargoes? Thomas Jefferson tried them. Rent too high? We've been arguing about that for a while. Each episode is proof. The past isn't that far away. Listen to History This Week, available now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Weeks ago, a new artificial intelligence program called ChatGPT made its debut online.
The chatbot has fascinated and terrified the internet with its incredible writing ability.
This is the most sophisticated AI chatbot that we have ever seen.
A research lab can write essays and carry on convincing written conversation.
The future is now. Are we ready for this brave new world?
In November 2022, ChatGPT launched. Within days, it had a million users. Within months, it was in college classrooms across the country, whether professors wanted it there or not. One of the core assumptions of college, that you learned by doing the work, was suddenly in question.
Students are using AI more every day, from solving math problems to writing essays.
Educators now fear they will not be able to distinguish whether assignments were written by a student or a bot.
Cheating in school existed long before AI, but now professors are tasked with finding the abuse.
But at what point does artificial intelligence stop being a tool for learning and become another way for students to cheat?
There was no playbook for what came next. Were professors supposed to change their curriculum, their assignments?
Educators need to adopt new approaches and grading methods as the technology becomes more prevalent in the classroom.
So we have to think about other forms of assessment, other ways that we can prepare students to use AI in a way that...
It's been 4 years, and the tools have only gotten better. They write research papers, they code, they solve problem sets, they can even pass the bar exam. So the question is getting more complicated. If AI can do the work, what's the point of college?
Is going to college a waste of time?
According to an Indeed report, 49% of Gen Z job hunters thinks that their college degree has lost value in the job market because of artificial intelligence.
Some administrators think they have an answer. Lean into it. Bring AI into the classroom. Teach students how to use it. But that's a bet. And not everyone is convinced it's the right one. One professor I spoke to thinks they're making a serious mistake. I'm Margot Gray. This week on Campus Files, should universities be restricting or embracing AI? When I was working on this episode, I read a lot of opinion pieces about AI in the classroom, pieces written by students, by administrators, by professors. One in particular stood out. It was an article in The Atlantic, the title, "Colleges Are Preparing to Self-Lobotomize." The author is Michael Clune. He teaches literature at Ohio State University.
I've taught a range of things. It's always focused on literature, but I've taught Jane Austen. I teach classes on dark comedy, science fiction, 19th century American literature.
Clune has been teaching for almost 2 decades. For most of those years, he saw very few instances of plagiarism, at least that he was aware of.
I tend not to have a suspicious attitude. I tend not to go looking at student work for evidence of plagiarism. I think it's sort of an ungenerous perspective, and for many years that worked great.
That changed in 2022, the year ChatGPT was released to the public. Tell me about the first time you saw AI, or at least suspected it, in your classroom.
It was a really weird thing because I started noticing, like, I'd have office hours, and usually I'd have like maybe 2 or 3 students come into office hours to chat about the book or whatever. And then I started noticing I was getting more visits from office hours, and they were from the students who kind of seemed the least engaged, which was always weird because usually you get visits in office hours from the students that are most engaged. But these students started coming to my office and they were asking me questions about the paper assignment, like, what should I do? And then I realized that what they were doing is they were asking me questions to feed into the prompts of the AI to develop papers that would meet my expectations.
But it wasn't just the office hours pattern. The papers themselves gave it away in 2 ways. The first was voice. The papers didn't sound like the students who wrote them, not even close to their in-class writing. The second was harder to name.
The papers had the kind of bland generality, the kind of vapid quality that sort of marks AI writing. There's really very little of the mark of the individual author, the kind of wonderful idiosyncrasy that would enable you and I, if we both look at the same passage by an author, we would both pick out different features and we would have different interpretations of those features. The AI tends to smooth that out. And when I had conversations with them about it, just asking them, you know, sort of to describe and defend some of the things they wrote about, they were unable to do so. And one of them admitted to me that, yeah, in fact, that's what they've been doing. And so I was just like, whoa, this is a whole new world.
Clune wasn't the only professor seeing this. His colleagues said they were suspecting AI in student writing too, but it was hard to prove. This problem created a market for software that was supposed to help. In April 2023, Turnitin, the plagiarism detection company many universities already used, rolled out an AI detector. It launched with a lot of fanfare. The pitch was simple. Paste a student paper into the software, and you'll get back a percentage showing how much of it was written by AI. Professors started using it, and almost immediately, the problem started. The detector flagged writing it shouldn't have, including lots of essays by non-native speakers.
The software includes an AI detection feature, but AI detection tools can produce both false positives and false negatives. My professors
this semester. There were students who failed assignments they'd actually written. Students dragged into academic misconduct hearings. OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT, tried to help. They put out their own AI detector. 6 months later, they quietly took it down. The reason they gave was its low rate of accuracy. The most talked about tool came from a Princeton senior, Edward Tian. He built it over winter break and called it GPT-0. The story took off. A student building a defense against the very technology disrupting his education. But GPT-0 had the same problem as everything else. It couldn't reliably tell the difference between AI and human writing. And slowly, universities started to pull back from detection altogether, which left professors back where they started, guessing, making judgment calls, deciding when to confront a student and when to let it go. Most of them still agreed on one thing, though. AI use was cheating, and it was their job to try to stop it. But at Ohio State, that consensus wasn't going to last, because the administration was about to step in.
In It's Sophia with an F, Franklin with the Y. And if you're looking for some bubblegum dum-dum podcast, then you are in the wrong place, baby. Whether I'm reminiscing on the trials and tribulations of working in the corporate world to recapping today's latest reality TV show, you're going to want to pull up a chair and stick around. It's a good time and always 100% unfiltered. Follow and listen to Sophia with an F wherever you get your podcasts.
In June 2025, Ohio State made an announcement. The school was adopting a new AI policy.
Ohio State is becoming the first university in the world to require AI fluency for every student.
Ohio State has a new initiative to give every undergraduate student the tools they need to effectively use AI. Beginning this fall,
Ohio State was launching something called the AI Fluency Initiative. Starting with the class of 2029, every undergraduate would be required to learn how to use AI. This included mandatory workshops, a required first-year seminar, a new course, Unlocking Generative AI, open to every major. The goal was simple. Every student would graduate fluent in AI. Here's how the provost describes it.
The question really is, as a university, how do we prepare our students to thrive in this world that they're going into? We need to figure out how to coexist and use AI. And the best way to do that is to dance with it and play with it and get comfortable with it.
To be clear, faculty aren't required to incorporate AI into their courses. Individual professors, like Clune, can still prohibit it on assignments and exams, but the university is incentivizing it. Every college at Ohio State, from engineering to social work, is now responsible for making sure its students graduate fluent in AI. That means existing courses get retrofitted. A writing class might add AI prompting. A biology lab might add AI data analysis. And new courses that incorporate AI will get built from scratch. Professors who sign on get rewarded. The university pays $300 to anyone who completes its AI fluency teaching endorsement.
We got the news mostly through emails from the administration that went out to the whole campus about AI initiatives, and we're going to be embedding AI in every major and in every discipline and in every department, and Ohio State is going to be at the forefront of AI in education.
What went into Ohio State's AI initiative? What kinds of conversations?
It was a kind of top-down initiative. If you put yourself in the administrator's position, they're very scared, right? Why are they scared? They're scared because all of a sudden, the degrees that they had been pushing, that universities have been pushing as a reason for going into debt, you know, you get a degree in computer science, you're going to have a good income and so forth. Well, all of a sudden, computer science majors have a higher unemployment rate than art history majors. So there's this growing sense that the model that you've been sort of working with is crumbling before your eyes.
Clune isn't surprised. He says that this is a pattern. A new technology rolls out, and school administrators, worried about being left behind, rush to adopt it. It's happened before, with tablets. In the early 2010s, school districts across the country spent billions putting tablets in classrooms. The promise was that technology would transform education. Here's President Obama talking about it in 2013.
I want to see a tablet that's the same price as a textbook. These are the tools that our children deserve. And there's no reason why we can't do all this. Because if we can bring our kids and our schools into the digital age, you can't tell me we can't start improving our early childhood education system and making high quality.
The promise didn't pan out. Schools spent billions on classroom technology, and test scores didn't go up. They went down.
What we found is actually these kinds of technologies have had a really erosive effect on student skills, on attention, on reading capacity. And these were all things that no one could have predicted at the time, and everyone was surprised by them. And now finally they're getting cell phones out of school classrooms, they're getting rid of iPads and so forth. And it just is a real basic principle, which is a complex technology is going to have unintended consequences. It's going to do things that you can't anticipate at first. So it's an act of profound irresponsibility to flood the lives of the most vulnerable growing children, learning children, with these technologies before you have any sense of what's going to be the reality. And we've learned that lesson over the past two decades.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second. Students are almost certainly going to have to use AI in their jobs, probably a lot of it. So why shouldn't they be using it in college?
The question I'm really addressing is not at all, should we or shouldn't we use technology? The question is this: if this technology is truly going to be earth-shattering and transform the way work works, what skills will best prepare students for that future?
The skill Ohio State is betting on is AI fluency. Clune thinks they've picked the wrong one. Michael Clune can't predict the job market. He doesn't know which industries will be wiped out or which new ones will emerge. But he's certain about one thing, that students who outsource their thinking to artificial intelligence won't be ready for whatever comes next. Assuming that AI will be central to almost every industry, what kinds of skills do you think students do need to cultivate?
The kind of things we're going to need are folks who know how to ask good questions. What's the most basic way that you interface with the AI? It's through the prompt or the question. A prompt is a question. How to ask questions is a real skill.
Clune brought up an example. In 1993, two researchers at the University of Michigan were studying addiction, and they asked a question that no one had ever thought to ask.
They asked the question, is liking something different from wanting it? What if you could really not like what a substance does to you, but still want it? I'm a recovering heroin addict. It's kind of a brilliant question because ordinarily you think, like, I take heroin, why? Because I like it. I like what it does to me. And when I saw that, I thought, like, oh my God, that's totally what addiction was like for me. I did not like what heroin was doing to me, but I wanted more and more of it. By asking that question, pulling apart liking and wanting, they were eventually able to isolate two different neural pathways that correspond to liking versus wanting. It was a really brilliant insight into how addiction works. It's just an example of how the capacity to ask a good question is a real skill and depends on all kinds of background knowledge.
Judging the answers is another skill entirely. Is the information true? Does it line up with what they already know? Does it change the picture or just fill it in? Clune says that kind of judgment is harder than it looks.
I know lots of friends who are in fields in which they, ranging from the sciences to the social sciences, in which they feel using AI is super helpful. But every one of them says, yes, this is super helpful to me, but it's helpful to me. I know how to use it. I can get good results from it because I spent decades being educated in this field and learning very slowly and with great difficulty how to analyze, how to make arguments, how to make judgments. Those are skills that are slowly and carefully and elaborately developed in college and in through K through 12. And the risk is that if you automate those, if you offload that work of thinking, analyzing, asking, evaluating to a machine, well, then you're never going to actually get that education.
The university isn't saying students should use AI to do all their work. It's saying AI can be a tool, something that augments their learning if they understand how to use it. Clune's fear is that there isn't actually a way to use AI that doesn't replace some student learning and thinking. So in his own classroom, he's asking his students to bet on something, that the slow, difficult work will pay off. He knows that's a hard ask right now.
I have a lot of empathy for them. It's an extraordinarily anxiety-producing moment. And I always try to think, okay, I'm at one situation. I'm 50 years old and, you know, tenured and sort of set in life and so forth. And this is causing me anxiety. But let me put myself in the situation of a 18, 20, or 22-year-old. And what they wonder is, what jobs will even be available for people?
The impact of AI on future job opportunities is not likely to be equal across the economy. A report published last year found high-earning workers with college degrees tend to be most at risk of losing jobs to AI. That includes lawyers, accountants, and middle managers. If you're looking,
parents and students are petrified, completely understandably so, given the job market. And no one knows what fields will thrive in the future. And what everyone has this idea is, I've somehow got to master, become quote unquote fluent in AI in order to succeed in the job market.
Kloon thinks AI fluency is the wrong answer. And he says he's not just guessing. He's been talking to employers in tech, in business. And what many of them want isn't necessarily what students think.
The basic thing is, employers will say, look, we've got these kids coming out of school who don't know how to think, don't know how to read, don't know how to really work. And everything they can do, we think, can be automated either now or in the near future. If all you've been doing is offloading your work to AI, the answer is going to be nothing. I can add nothing to it. Everything I do can be automated. So I'm asking, and I think a serious way, how do we use technology rather than be used by technology?
You won't be surprised to hear Kloon is keeping AI out of his classroom entirely.
Instead of the papers, there will be exams, in-class blue book exams, pen and paper, in which there will be essay questions that they'll answer about the material in class.
But blue books only work for exams. Kloon still wants to assign long essays, the kind that students write at home. So he's working on a new idea for next year.
Which is having them do essays, but then once they've done their essay and handed it in, each student has to have a 15 to 20 minutes one-on-one session with me in which they basically do an oral defense of what they've written. And I think that has really good educational value apart from any AI concerns, in that it asks you, okay, you argue this. Why do you argue this? You know what I mean? Like, what's your evidence? Or how did you think about selecting evidence for this and so forth?
The oral defense idea has limits. It's time consuming and it doesn't scale, especially in larger classes. But Kloon has an even bigger worry. Will students even sign up for his class in the first place? He's heard that soon, Ohio State students might be able to filter the course catalog, look specifically for classes that integrate AI. And if that happens, classes like his could get passed over. Still, despite all that, Kloon says something good has come out of all of this, something he didn't expect.
It's giving me a sense of the preciousness and the value of things that we sometimes took for granted before. Having a group of students read a work of literature, that is no longer something you just assign and forget about it and expect. It's now something that we see as a really a kind of privilege and a gift. Both me and the students working to carve out time and space in which they can wrestle with a great work of literature.
Kloon isn't alone in this. A few hundred miles away, at Boston College, an English professor named Carlo Rotella has been wrestling with the same questions. He says his thinking could change. AI moves fast. But for now, he's landed somewhere close to Kloon.
Over the past year, the tone was kind of gloom and doom, and it was, no one's ever going to read anything again. No one's ever going to write anything again. Why would anyone bother to do that? Which, to me, kind of misses most of the point of what we're doing in a classroom. What are we doing in an English course? Like, well, what we're definitely not doing is trying to produce more okay English papers. So yes, ChatGPT can do that, but that's not the point of an English class. The point of an English class is to practice the skill of extracting meaning from the world around you and then building arguments based on evidence to support that interpretation, which is just a basic skill.
AI has forced Rotella to have to articulate to his students what an English class is actually for.
I do think it is incumbent on teachers to be much clearer about what we're doing and why we're doing it. And say, okay, well, now we're going to do this thing, and this thing is designed to make you stronger and faster in this way. Rather than saying, sort of assuming, this is great literature, everybody knows that, let's get to it.
To make the case, Rotella uses an analogy about the gym.
How do you get stronger and faster? You do that by doing your own work. You run your own laps, you lift the weights. You know, the point of the gym is not for the weights to go up and down. It's for you to lift them, right? And so now there's a machine that makes the weights go up and down. It's not actually that important or relevant if the idea is to get stronger. Using a bot to do the reading and writing is like joining the track team. In fact, it's like paying $100,000 a year to join the track team and then doing your laps on an electric scooter. You went around the track. Congratulations. but you're no stronger, you're no faster, and basically anybody can ride that scooter, so what do we need you for?
How do students tend to respond?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole range there. There are some very transactional students, and there have always been some very transactional students, and they had other technology and other possibilities open to them in the past, and now they have this thing right in their laps that allows them to be very transactional. But there's plenty of students who aren't that way, students who are happy to hear that the right way to do it is to do your own work. And if you're being truly calculating and actually calculating correctly and weighting things correctly, that is the solution. The right answer is you're spending $100,000 a year on this, you should do your own work and get stronger and faster and better.
At Ohio State, Michael Kloon said he's been seeing something similar. What surprised him is how many students have told him they don't like the technology, how much they resent what it's doing to their own learning.
You know, 1999, when they pulled people on the internet, which was just coming online then, 70% of people were super excited about it. Now those numbers have flipped. And I see that everywhere. I see that in students. And I would say students, more than anyone else, view AI with fear and skepticism, but also a horrified sense that they may have to use it. There may be no escape from it. The students I talk to tend to be more in this space of offer us some hope that there's some future for human creativity and knowledge beyond the machine, beyond a kind of tech dystopia.
That fear isn't just in Kloon's classroom.
I know what many of you are feeling about that. I can hear you.
You could hear it at college graduations this spring. At the University of Arizona, former Google CEO Eric Schmidt told graduates that the AI transformation ahead would be larger, faster, and more consequential than what came before.
There is a fear in your generation that the future has already been written, that the machines are coming, that the jobs are evaporating.
The response? Booing.
Interesting.
Which is kind of a strange thing at a graduation. Commencement speeches are supposed to be hopeful.
You are inheriting a mess that you did not create. And I understand that fear.
But for some students, talk about the future wasn't landing that way anymore. Special thanks to Dr. Will Teague at Angelo State University. If you've got a story idea, we would love to hear about it. Send us an email at campusfilespod@gmail.com. And if you're loving this podcast, be sure to click follow on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. While you're there, leave us a review and a 5-star rating. Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast hosted by Margot Gray and Ian Mont. Our executive producers are Leah Reese-Dennis and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont and Margot Gray. Sound design and engineering by Andy Jaskowitz and Zach Clark. Legal support by Laura Berman and Melissa Jean. Original music by Davey Sumner. Special thanks to Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Hilary Schuff, Eric Donnelly, Kate Hutchison-Rose, Sean Cherry, Kurt Courtney, and Lauren Vieira.
Hey there, it's Jill Schlesinger. I'm launching a new show. It's called Money Moves, and your money is going to move. We're going to help you make better financial decisions. We're going to call out the BS you're finding all over social media. We're going to give you actionable guidance to make your financial life clearer, less stressful. We're going to answer your financial questions and take the mystery out of your financial life. Follow and listen to Money Moves with Jill Schlesinger wherever you get your podcasts.